Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in again. This week, we're joined by the founders of the Sydney-based international fund manager, Aoris, who have a unique and interesting perspective on owning listed assets. Mr. Stephen Arnold, who is the managing director and CIO of Aoris, has spent 30 years in the finance industry and is a chartered financial analyst. He is joined by Daniel McAuliffe, the business development manager, who's been working alongside Stephen for the last 4 years. And these gentlemen are very good at what they do, investing in high conviction, quality focused companies and reliable growth over the long term. And obviously we're similar here at Seneca with our investment philosophy. And I think Luke and Stephen seem to think about the problem of investing in a certain way. As always, if you'd like to learn more about Seneca or interested in becoming a client, send myself or Luke an email. Or if you'd like more information about Aoris, please don't hesitate to give us a ring and make sure to check out their website, aorisim.com.au. And also, Luke has been writing some great content on his weekly note, which comes out every Monday afternoon. If you're interested in that, go to senecafs.com.au/subscribe and get onto it. And once again, if you have a question for us we'd love to answer, please write in at jordant@senecafs.com.au, as any question answered on the show, of course, will receive a signed copy of my book, Man Alive. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast. Let's get into the show. It was a great experience for me to sit next to two brilliant investors and listen to them talk about their process, philosophy, and ideas. And there's probably quite a few terms or ideas maybe that you're not familiar with and new to you, so I recommend you take some notes, jump on Google, really learn as much as you can from this episode. And they talk fast, they go deep, they get into the details. And so with that long introduction, let's hand it over to Stephen and Daniel. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Seneca Financial Solutions podcast. I'm here with Luke Laretive.
Still here, still breathing.
And I've also got two more guests with me from Aoris Investment Management, Stephen Arnold and Daniel McAuliffe. How are you today, boys?
Good, great. Jordan. Hello, Luke.
Thank you for having us on.
Good afternoon, gents.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time this afternoon. Very lucky to have the guys in today. Really excited to ask them a little bit more about their fund, what they're doing. Stephen's a very, very smart man, makes me look stupid. I'm sure we can have a chat about portfolio management, running stocks, running teams, starting a business. There's lots of fun stuff we can chat about. And I'm sure Dan will have some nice anecdotes from the road as well for us. So why don't you tell us what you're doing out in Melbourne and why you've graced us with your presence this afternoon and what's happening at Aoris.
Sure. Well, at Aoris, we run an international equity portfolio. It's quite distinct. It's very concentrated. We own only 15 stocks. We're long only, so we own businesses. And we want to own super high quality businesses that become more valuable over time. And we don't think there's a ton of them that are available at the prices that make them a good investment. And we own stocks that are somewhat different from many other managers. We tend to fish in a pretty discrete, distinct part of the universe. It's a very conservative approach. Our starting point is to protect client capital. So along with great quality businesses, we want conservative balance sheets and pretty sensible management. So we're here in Melbourne to talk to sort of groups and clients that are interested in international equities, and we find that our distinct and conservative approach is really resonant. There's lots of issues that people rightly worry about, whether it's rising interest rates or concerns about the tech sector, and our conservative approach we feel is very relevant in this sort of environment. We like owning businesses with conservative balance sheets, where as debt becomes more expensive, we're going to be in a good place, and we don't own some of the other racy fang names that people might be concerned about. So
that's stuff that I own.
That's why. That's why we're here today.
No, it's great. I really like the. I mean, we see lots of fund managers. Everyone wants to come through. I generally just don't take the meetings anymore. But the first time I met you guys, I liked a couple of things in particular about the fund and your approach. And I liked that you just stay in, number one thing, and I always say this to clients and what we do as well, is just stay in your lane. Like, you just do what you do and you try and do it to like the very best of your ability, and just don't worry about the rest. There's so much you can invest in, and there's so many opportunities to do 1,000 different things poorly. Like, just sort of stick with the kind of companies that you like to own, the things that you feel comfortable investing in, the things you understand really well, and just do those. And yep, long short does well in certain markets, and yep, momentum does great, and some guys' derivatives trading strategy might crush returns. Fantastic, good luck to them. But I like the guys who just stay in their lane and do what they do and stay true to label. I think that's something you guys are really good at and convey well. And I think the other thing I liked about the fund and about the approach was just that your approach is very, very different. So your investment process, and I don't fully pretend to understand it, but I think the way you don't look at consensus forecasts, you don't look at earnings revisions, you don't even look at any, there's no forecasting. It's all about looking at the historical, performance of the business, and then making up your own ideas on how things are going to happen internally. And you just don't worry about anybody else or what they're doing, and you just figure out what's valuable to you as an investment class, or as an investor, I should say, and what's valuable, therefore to your unit holders or investors. So I don't know if that's right, but that's kind of what I've sort of gleaned from Aorus so far.
Yeah, okay, Luke, that's a really authentic representation of what we do and don't do.
Yeah.
And we want to do one thing well, and there are large parts of the market or types of decisions that we're happy not to do and not to participate in because we don't think that we'll do it well repeatedly. So repeatability is really important.
Yeah, I like it.
And we think about, well, let's think about oil prices. 6 weeks ago, everyone thought they were going to 100. Now,
they're 20.
It could be quite different. So were we to own oil stocks, we'd be having to think about that. And is that a decision that we can get right repeatedly well? Or if we were thinking about interest rates or thinking about trade wars and businesses that export, is that a type of decision that we can make repeatedly well?
I had a client this morning chatting to me on the phone about, he'd been reading about what the Fed chat had been overnight, and he's trying to tell me what the Fed's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, mate, I've got no idea what the Fed's going to do tomorrow. Like, I wasn't sitting around the table. I got no ends to yelling or anybody else, And anyone who pretends that they do, I think, is kidding themselves. And like you said, it's the same with commodity prices. I worked at Vale for a few years before I was doing this. And my job was to build the supply-demand model for steel globally. We went and mapped every single supply-demand blast furnace in the whole world, what they would need over the space of a year for iron ore and coal. We had all the inside information. We're the biggest supplier of iron ore, one of the biggest suppliers of coal, biggest supplier of manganese, and we still couldn't figure it out. Like, what hope does some analyst at Macquarie Bank or anywhere else, I'm not teasing Macquarie, but the point, have hope with no inside information, and having a chat to two or three coal traders at Glencore once a month. To me, it's crazy. So yeah, I kind of think the same. It's just do the things that you can actually do with a high degree of probability of success.
Yeah, I think the financial market's one where it's easy to introduce complexity.
Mm.
There's all sorts of funky things that we can do. And sometimes it makes us feel sophisticated. It makes us feel smart. So we can sort of short stocks, take active views on currencies, think hard about what Trump is going to do and externalities. But if you can do that well, that's okay. Our approach is just different, so we're thinking, look,
my question is can you do that well? Question mark. I think there are people who do that well.
Can you keep it simple well, or can you?
Well, no. Can you do all these other crazy things that people are doing well? I would argue that highly resourced. There's certain corners of the market who have been able to do it. But I think by and large, if you're going to be a fund manager sitting in Sydney or Melbourne or in Perth or Brisbane or wherever in Australia, even in Singapore or Hong Kong or New York, anywhere, and try and do everything well and pretend like you're going to capture every bit of alpha that's rolling around the market, it just seems like lunacy to me. It's just so big.
Yeah, so it's we call it common sense investing. executed with uncommon discipline. Let's sort of throw our business in. So sometimes we can sort of go from the abstract to, so we own Compass Group. They happen to report very good earnings last night. So
congrats.
They're a bit like Spotless. They're the largest contract catering business in the world. And they're very focused on just doing one thing well. And some of their competitors do a lot of other things as well, like elevator security and front desk security and garden maintenance. And Compass View, we're going to do our best job and grow the fastest, most profitably if we can focus on doing one thing well. It's food, and they're growing at an underlying rate of 5 or 6% per annum. They keep their customers on average for about 25 years, and so their customer retention rate's extraordinarily high.
That's something you look up. Yeah, I reckon that's the second or third time I've heard you talk about customer retention. I reckon that's one of your. You like that a lot.
I think if you're a good business and you look after your customers, you deliver something of value, then an end product of that is going to be happy customers that stay around a long time. And we don't want customers that stay a long time because they have no choice and they're unhappy, because at some point there will be a choice and then they'll go. So we want satisfaction and retention and profitability.
And ideally a little bit of like price increases.
That's right. And it's becoming more important as tight labour markets mean inflation is now becoming a bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a bigger separation between companies that are in fact able to pass on their cost inflation through to their customers.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the philosophy that Compass takes to pricing. It's like, look, our first port of call is internal. And what we're going to try and do firstly is offset through productivity, the food inflation, labour inflation,
mm-hmm.
because customers are outsourcing this to us because they think that we can do it better and cheaper. And so our responsibility is firstly to try and manage that. And once we've done our best job on productivity, then we'll look to prices, but prices is not the first place we go. And I think that's a good mentality.
Stephen, I know some of the best insight and some of the greatest understanding, and particularly filling in the holes from a financial perspective when you're working on a company, come from seeing the whites of somebody's eyes and spending time with the business. I remember when I went up and saw Select Harvest up in Mildura for 2 days. I did a tour up there. It was five years ago now, but I just had no idea about almonds, and I walked away and I knew how it all kind of fitted together, and I kind of had a really good concept of the business. Now, you know, buy it, don't buy it, good business, bad business, to the side. I had a really good understanding. How do you find investing in huge companies, some of the businesses you own, the Accentures of the world, you know, they're very, very large companies. How do you get that level of white to their eyes insight? How do you get your corporate access, I suppose, being a small fund at the moment and that kind of thing?
You know, the access is surprisingly good. In fact, the first 2 weeks of December, I'll be visiting about 35, 36 companies across the US and Europe. And for many of those businesses, you know, I am seeing the CFO or the CEO.
Fantastic.
And they like the fact that we've physically come a long way. That helps. They like the fact that I think that we're fundamental long-term investors. We're trying to understand how they think, how they operate, not what next quarter's earnings are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
They like the fact that we're long-only. We're not going to short their stock.
That helps.
That's right. So for two of the businesses that we own, I'm getting, as well as seeing the CFO or the CEO, having a factory tour. And you learn a ton walking around the factory, talking to a plant manager. And we're talking about productivity. So one business we happen to own is called Graco, based in Minneapolis near 3M. They make highly engineered equipment to mix and dispense fluids. And one application you'd see is professional paint spraying equipment, where they have more than half the world market for the very high-end machines. And a couple of years ago, when I walked the plant, which I've done several times, they're talking about factory-level productivity. How do we reduce our unit costs? But also, how do we improve our product? And one of the examples that they gave was, look, one of the ways that people use our product is to spray railway rolling stock. So there's a lot of surface area to cover, and when you're spraying it, a lot of the paint ends up in the air. And it's got environmental implications, and it also costs a lot of paint. And what we've been able to do is to electrostatically charge the paint as it's dispensed. and it's like magnetically attracted to
people. Are too clever, aren't they? They're just like literally the engineers, they're just clever people.
It's fantastic. And these are, you know, this is the middle America, this is what they do very well. And
I've a bit of an affinity with Minnesota. My basketball team's from Minnesota, so I go the Wolves.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we're mid-season. So it's that's something that you can sort of learn and pick up through walking the floor, and they're kind of proud about it. It's about how do we deliver value to customers, and they're not talking about sort of acquisitions or other sort of corporate level things. It's real value to their customers, and that's how they manage to earn very high profit margin to generate good growth and sort of create new applications and new markets.
I think we talk about brand a lot on this podcast. I'm a bit of a marketing slut, so like I'm just obsessed about marketing and sales. I just love it, right? So
hence that big Seneca poster in the corner.
But I think a lot of the things you're talking about are brand. That's brand, you know, and culture. Like a plant floor that are proud of the innovations that they're helping a company deliver. It's an intangible, and it's hard to quantify that, but it's the kind of thing. I remember when I looked at ARB Group here in Australia, you know, many, many years ago doing my university assignment. And I remember just thinking, like, this is a proud business. This is a business who are very, very proud of the product innovation and the market they've essentially developed and cornered for themselves out of a garage in the Northern Territory, two brothers, you know. You can feel that. And at the time, it wasn't in the PE, but it certainly is now.
How did you feel that? Were you in the actual...
No, I never went there, but just like when we saw the company in the office and no one was really looking at it. It was really illiquid stock. The stock, they did a bit of a share split and made it a bit easier to trade, but very, very illiquid, barely traded, owned by the family. And, you know, they were spending all their money on R&D and essentially had this captive market of sort of four-wheel drive enthusiasts in Australia who literally would buy every single product they put out. They would sell out. Like, it was like Supremes and, you know, Nike sneakers, limited run sneakers before that happened, you know. These guys are like 40 and 50 and 60 year old blokes driving around Australia getting themselves bogged for fun on the weekends. Like, it's not my idea of fun, but it's that same sort of idea of, you know, everyone who worked there, they worked in the factory floor, they all would just, you know each other, have beers on a Friday, and they had a great culture around building innovative, unique products for this captive market. And kind of just, you know, those kind of businesses that they're super high quality, not just because of the financials, high quality financials, but that actually is really a manifestation of a high quality culture. And I think that's kind of the unique thing that's hard to price and find, but when you do, it's kind of nice. It's a nice thing to remember, you know, especially if you've got to pay up a little bit for it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think sort of culture matters, and the longer the term investor you are, the more it matters. And it percolates up through how the company communicates, what's important to them, how long people stick around. So as well as the customer retention, the employee retention is important as well. And particularly in tight employment markets, well, you know, you've got to have a reason for people to stay other beyond the paycheck.
Yeah.
And so we talk about a culture of meaning and purpose. You know, is there, I'll give you a good example. If every time I've been to L'Oreal in Paris, I'm going there again in a few weeks.
Lucky. That's a good site visit, I'll tell you that much.
They give you a little goodie bag at the end.
Yeah.
They love beauty, and it's a bit different from some of their peers, like a Unilever or Procter & Gamble, the personal care businesses that are wrapped up in a complex organisation where there's a lot of restructuring going on, there's a lot of M&A going on, and there's no beauty culture. There's lots of things that they do. For L'Oreal, that's all they do.
Yeah.
And there's not been a lot of M&A activity over time, so the people at work there are L'Oreal people,
mm-hmm.
rather than a kind of smash together a variety of different businesses. And it really comes through in the results. And they generate, you know, great product that their customers love. And I think part of it is that people love to be there. They you know, communicate well, and they do cool things. They're in touch with their customers. So as you said, the culture with a meaning, purpose, that people are excited to be there. It's, you know, more than just a job. You know, they feel that they're doing something that's different, you know, creating value.
Yeah, definitely.
And in businesses like Agreco, people get excited about, well, like, I've managed to electrostatically paint, I guess. and the customers, it's going to
value, add value for somebody at the end of the day.
That's right. Mm. It's differentiated. It's going to allow them to do things that they couldn't do before. That's exciting.
When I would consider your investment process, it's a refined, mature version of what I'm trying to do here for my clients. And I think it's really, I just kind of wonder, is this something that you stumbled upon or you sort of copied and morphed, or this investment process, or is this something you've just kind of back tested and you found it worked, or how did you sort of conceptualize the Aorus investment process? What was sort of the light bulb moment for you?
Well, I think it's a journey with some kind of discrete steps over time. And having a healthy feedback loop, having an appetite to learn, because not every decision goes right. So you want to learn hard from the ones that do and the ones that don't. You know, be a hungry learner and look into what other people are doing, investment markets. And the periods where there's been, if you like, big learning experiences. I was the tech analyst during the dot-com bubble in 2000. So I was at the sharp end of some gross excesses. And then I was a banks analyst at Goldman Sachs Asset Management in a portfolio that we were running for the high net worth clients of Goldman Sachs during the GFC.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, it's a really intense learning periods from in what you observe and what companies tell you, what they don't tell you, what makes a durable business in times of stress, what makes your own human biases, and what sort of fluff that people are liable to get seduced by.
Yeah.
And so those things shape your own, certainly my mental processes, or also describe it as an evidence-based approach. So it goes from reading a lot of what other investors have done, and also what's evidentially or statistically worked. And a great source of that learning was a terrific guy called James Montier, M-O-N-T-I-E-R,
yep.
Who's written two particularly good books, one called Behavioral Investing,
mm-hmm.
and one called Value Investing. And he really goes through a lot of different facets of investing and tests them and looks at what the academic evidence supports and doesn't support. And a lot of the popular conceptions are in fact misconceptions. And he talks a lot about forecasting and growth. And what he's able to show is that people, you know, they're wired optimistically. We tend to overestimate future growth rates. And two, our ability to separate average growers from low growers and high growers is very, very limited. And which would probably be a challenging concept for a lot of financial analysts and practitioners to accept, but that's really what the evidence shows. So we sort of take that on board, and well, how can we have a process that rather than
doesn't rely on that,
leaning heavily on future forecasts, and DCS would be a good example. That's very sort of hardwiring optimism in. And so I'm as human as everybody else, and I'm as liable to overestimate future growth. So let's not do it that way. Let's value trailing earnings, sort of what a company has done, rather than what we estimate that it could do in the future.
So particularly if you've got a stable business, I suppose or a stable management team, stable culture, the things we've just been through, it all of a sudden puts a lot more onus on the future, puts a lot more onus on what's happened in the past, because it's the same people with the same biases and the same vibe and the same outlook trying to do something a little bit better, incrementally better next year. And I think that and the year after, and the year after, and the year after.
That's exactly right. So as investors, every year we're trying to do a bit better. And we want to own businesses that have a strong appetite for improvement. They want to deliver better products to their customers and win more business. And they want to internally become more productive. Greco is a terrific example of that internal and external improvement. But what we're not doing is owning businesses that we assume are going to be dramatically different or better. There's no sense of corporate turnaround. You know, someone sailing in from the Wild West and turning a bad business into a good business. It doesn't happen.
More likely a bad business into a not so bad business.
That's right. Yeah. It's the sense of sort of transformational. It's we can all get excited about what the future might hold, but then when we think evidentially, well, you know, what's the kind of conversion rate of sort of promise to profit? You know, there's a lot of promise. Of 10 exciting businesses, well, which ones in 10 years' time will still be profitable? You know, so thinking hard about failure rates and And rather than sort of fishing in that pool of exciting could-bes, and we want to fish in a pool of more reliable, actually has delivered, and you know, businesses like Agraco that's been around for more than half a century would be a good example of that.
It must be difficult. I mean, I find it hard, and I'm sure you guys do too. You have this long-term approach. Everything you're doing is pointing to a generational or multi-generational kind of outlook. But you have to fight the daily news cycle. You have to fight the quarterly reporting. You have to fight your clients who are getting fed, you know, information from everywhere. I'm sure in 1987, you know, that you didn't have so much information, and you didn't have to be such a curator of information for your clients. And I'm sure you maybe have it a little bit less at the sort of fund level where you don't have the high touch, but you know, I certainly feel it here. It must be difficult when, you know, your quarterly returns come out and you're under by 2% or 1% or some pissy amount, it doesn't matter, in the grand scheme of things, and you're getting asked, you know, why aren't you outperforming? I don't care, but the point is it must be it's a hard thing to deal with, right? It's a difficult conversation.
I think everyone's attention span has been slightly shifted over time to be shorter and shorter, and there's a sort of sense of immediate gratification.
Absolutely.
And so I guess we want to encourage clients to think like we do, which is long term.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And we're very transparent about what we do. And
you do really good quarterlies, by the way, or monthlies, so I see them.
Thank you. And also, like, how we operate as a business, what we own, how we think, what we aspire to be. So we're not going to be a great match. We can try and work that at an early stage for clients that have got a different expectation set, different appetite than what we can deliver. Then, you know, when there's going to be other managers that are better suited for them.
Correct.
So the more transparent that we can be, I think the better that match of client and manager that we're going to be able to do. And also being conservative and sensible in what we promise. I think if we hold out heroic promises, we'll create disappointment, and we want to be conservative in that.
Hard to do though when you're at a competition for capital, you know, and there's a there's a reward for having massive inflow, and you know that's how you make money. It's you charge clients fees, and we're in the same boat. But and a lot of clients do behave on, they react on excitement, they react on fear, they react on excitement, they react on fear, and you end up going nowhere. And so I think it's quite a boring and steady approach, but ironically, that's actually how you achieve your goals. It's kind of, there's no quick fix to these things. It's just as slow and steady as she goes. And yep, you'll have some volatility along the way, particularly if you're running a concentrated portfolio of 15 things. But I think at the end of the day, quality, I can't think of a market where quality and reasonable prices don't prevail. It doesn't really make sense that they don't.
Yeah.
To me,
yeah. I invite Daniel to offer your thoughts on.
Yeah,
how we,
sure. I think it's probably more for the advisor to, as well, like wealth advisors, independent financial advisors, and to train their clients to understand that, you know, the, I guess when you look at charts of stock returns over, you know, 50 years, you look at 1 month or. A small little blip. So you see volatility and you think, okay, well, hold on, that's not really a big deal. But of course, everyone will look at, you know, the last 2 months.
Recent
bias,
right?
The media will definitely magnify maybe the last 2 or 3 months. Whereas you sort of look, okay, well, hold on, let me just see how stock returns have done over the last, you know, decade compared to this. Well, this isn't really anything. You know, what am I stressing about?
As a product, you know, as a differentiated product in the market, I think. You know, when you're running concentrated and you're running, you know, 15 stocks or 20 stocks, whatever it might be at any given time, and also you're just focusing on quality, really. Quality over everything else, and then at a reasonable price. And that reasonable price might not be apparent straight away. And, you know, these businesses often don't come face value 1 year forward earnings cheap. You know, it's not always the cheapest thing in the market that you're buying. Like you said, you're not buying the corporate turnaround and you're not buying the 38 times high growth thing. So it's sometimes a difficult sell, I reckon, anyway. Like I'm in the same boat. It's kind of what we do. So I just wonder why clients don't focus on it more. And yet it's always going to be the fund with the highest return number on the Mercer tables, which everyone's going to want to put money into, which to me is just like chasing the highest return stock. It's kind of exactly the same.
Yeah, and it's likely to be a different manager every month or a different manager every year. However, you definitely would encourage people to look over a longer time horizon, you know, that 3, 5, 10 year track records. So Stephen, you know, managed funds at a previous firm for 6.5 years. You know, we've currently been, you know, running money at Aorus for probably just under a year.
Yeah.
But I think what's important is that rather than trying to find cheap stocks and then hurry to find good reasons to purchase it before the price moves, our process is the reverse of that, which is let's just try and find the best quality businesses that we're happy to, you know, to purchase. And we could, you know, the stock market could close for the next 5 years or so.
You'd still own the same businesses.
And we'd still own those businesses. And we'll research them, we'll get to know them better, we'll speak to management, and then when the price, we feel we're comfortable with the price, then we're actually happy to make a purchase, and initially probably a smaller weighting in the portfolio, and then as we even get to know it better, and it proves itself even more, a higher weighting.
Is that how you think about execution in terms of a scale in, sort of scale out sort of type, based on valuation and based on how you think the market's pricing a particular asset? Is that sort of how you look at it, or is it more of you're just building a position until as your fund grows?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think so. There's the higher weights will definitely be due to a discount to what we think it's worth, or discount to intrinsic value. But also, it's also about us even being, you know, familiar with the stocks as well. I mean, we, you know, not to say that the lower weighting stocks we're unfamiliar with, or less familiar,
but you build conviction. That's normal.
Build conviction, and as quarter by quarter, the more you talk to management, you know, face to face, and both in seeing the earnings comments,
and also just being able to see the difference between a promise and a delivery. You know, like you can look back in time and say, yeah, they said that and did that, but you didn't see the thing that they didn't say and did, or did say and didn't do. So I think that's like a real hindsight, 2020 hindsight type sort of analysis, where when you're actually playing in the forward period, you have to be, okay, we've said that, we think they're going to deliver, there's no indication that they won't, so we can make a smaller investment, and then they actually delivered, and they've actually come out with something that we also think they can do, so now we can have greater conviction that they're going to be on attempt 2 and 3 and 4, they're going to be successful at that too.
The only thing that you touched on, a really good point, which is, you know, the say to do ratio.
Yeah.
And look, we work very hard to have a pretty common sense proposition and then stick to it and communicate to clients clearly. And we look for businesses who do the same. And by watching them over time, we can see where there's a variance between what they say and what they do. Whereas rather than making a sort of snap character judgment over a short period of time, a good example is a terrific business we know, which is called Experian, which is the largest credit bureau in the world. And
it's like a Dun & Bradstreet type sort of setup, credit bureau. Is that the same sort of thing?
But so much better.
So much better.
So Dun & Bradstreet, they provide credit reports about 100 million small businesses.
Yeah.
But that's a business that I don't think has evolved very much over time. So Experian, they do operate in the business credit market, where they're gaining share against Dun & Bradstreet, but their biggest market is the consumer market, where they have hundreds of millions of consumer credit reports, which help banks make decisions. Now, if we go back a couple of years, there's part of their business, a small but important part, where consumers will access their services to monitor their own credit profile. So if I've missed a loan repayment, if I'm going to remortgage, how's that going to change my credit profile? That was used to be a subscription service of about, you know, $20 a month. Now that market changed a bit, and there was a new entrant competitor who was able to do it for free by taking people's data and selling it for leads. And Experian sort of thought very hard about this, and they worked to reposition that business by adding value, having a premium service, as well as having a free service. Now, their biggest competitor took a different approach, which was, we're going to sell our data to this new competitor. Now, Experian's, I thought, was the most thoughtful approach, the most patient approach, and it's also paying off as their business is now growing again. And so that's one where, as we look over the last couple of years, I think the say-to-do ratio is very high. Strategically thoughtful, yeah, good execution, and willing to make an investment in that business, willing to absorb the temporary correction, but knowing that, you know, this is how we're going to grow it successfully. And I like the fact that they've stayed the course, transparent along the way of this is what we're trying to achieve, mm-hmm. this is why we're doing it that way, and then now it's delivering great results.
Guys, tell me the important thing. How can people get money into your fund? What are the different... I like what you're doing with this little suite of stuff, so I'll give you an open floor. Dan, how do people put money into Aorus and give Stephen some of their hard-earned dough?
Yeah, sure. So investors can use our unit trust. We've got...
listed, unlisted?
Unlisted.
Unlisted, cool.
Unlisted at the moment. We have we've got two options, which is a currency unhedged version.
Yep.
And also we've got a class which is currency hedged. Now there's two fee options for each class.
Yeah.
Can I stop you there, Daniel? There's a lot of people at home that may not understand the difference between the hedging and non-hedging trust. Just want to quickly explain that and then move on to it.
Sure. So an investor that will put money into our currency unhedged, will it be exposed to the performance of the underlying securities, of course, so the stocks in our portfolio, the 15 businesses mm-hmm. at the moment. But they'll also be exposure to the currencies in which those companies where are they domiciled. So for instance, we've got five UK companies, we have one French stock, and we've got nine US companies. So the investors will, you know, have exposure to euro, British pound, and US dollars. Mm. If they wish to take out the risk of the FX being either for or against them,
yeah,
they can choose the currency hedge version, which is basically hedged against the Australian dollar, which means that you're just having the returns of the actual stocks themselves.
Not great, in Aussie dollars. Mm. So and that's two very plain vanilla options, because we don't want to take active views on currencies.
Yeah.
It goes back to where do we think we can add value? Where do we think we're going to have a high degree of repeatability? But we also know that not every client's decisions or preferences are the same. You know, some people want to be hedged all the time and they're not exposed to movements in the Australian dollar, and others want to be unhedged and others will have particular views on the currency. So create options, but very clear and plain vanilla options.
Do you persuade or perhaps educate people on which option might be best for them, hedged or unhedged?
No, we don't give advice. Yeah. That's actually your job, guys.
That's me. I think it's a pretty clear distinction. If you're looking for currency diversification, then you would go in the unhedged version. And if you're looking for, you know, you're happy with a dollar and you're probably looking for a bit more certainty around, you know, where you'll end up at the end of the year, end of the month, end of the quarter, the hedge version works. If you want to speculate on currency, there's smarter, easier, more liquid ways, cheaper ways to do it than give it to Stephen. Cool. So then you've got that hedge version, unhedged version, you've got the unit trust in a normal statement every month kind of setup. And do you have, you got the SMA, are you running an SMA as well?
Yeah, sure. So just with the unit trust, I should add that the minimum investment is $20,000.
Cool.
Okay. And then
most people on this podcast are going to have no dramas with $20,000.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And then I guess we also make the portfolio available as an SMA, on a couple of platforms. We make the unit trust available on even more platforms. Yeah. So, Netwealth, Hub24, Macquarie, Power App, OneView. If I missed any, that's the unit trust is available on those platforms.
You've done a good job getting that distribution. That's good, really good for you guys.
Yeah. It's
especially quickly. Like that's been a quick. I know guys have been trying to do all that kind of stuff for ages. Other funds. So yeah, good job.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I think we've we've made a lot of ground, you know, with the platform, in the platform space, which is good. It just allows, I guess, more financial advisors such as yourself to be able to use us if they'd like to, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, in terms of scale for their client base. And then for the managed account, we have, Aorus has a managed account product, which is for wholesale investors only.
Uh-huh.
So the minimum is $250,000, and the clients are able to basically buy the underlying security, so all 15 stocks, with their own cost, have their own cost bases as they invest. We basically invest on that same evening into the market.
Into the model, yep.
So that's available on two platforms, Premium and OneView.
Yep.
And we'll look to expand that to other platforms as you know, based on demand.
Yeah, cool.
But
I think that's something that my clients might be interested in looking at. Is the SMA already on Premium? We're already a model manager on Premium, so it kind of, that kind of stuff is easy for us to do, and I think that would suit people. I think they'd like to see the individual stock lines and be able to manage their cost bases and tax stuff, you know, on their own. I think clients, if you're interested in that, you can just send me an email or call as per usual, and I can tell you a bit more about the process and how it works and that kind of stuff.
Great.
So might wrap it up, let the boys go and get something to eat, and we might knock off and go to the gym. So I'll thank you guys very much for coming in, and really appreciate your time, and I encourage everybody to get onto the AORUS website and follow the guys on LinkedIn. Lots of good content Stephen's putting out, and working really hard at the comms game, so get on and support them, and also have a look at the product on the website. It's something that I don't think anyone else is really doing in the market. It is a definite diversifier. It's true to label, and I think it's a good product. So, my ringing endorsement.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap it up, gentlemen?
Where's the ASX 200 going to end the year? I'm joking.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks to Luke. Thanks to Jordan. Thanks, Seneca, for having us. Really appreciate a fun discussion, and I look forward to working with you guys in the future.
Cool.
Thanks very much, guys.
Fantastic. Pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.